Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Wednesday, September 27, 2023. President Salva Kiir heads to Moscow to meet the isolated Russian leader.
With the war in Sudan, the Russians can have some of their own food in Sudan. Why? Because I think they have an agreement to have a naval base in Port Sudan.
And a South Sudanese analyst says the SPLM faction, loyal to Riek Machar, has surrendered to President Salva Kiir.
It's basically an agreement between the parties to continue to have their posh offices while the rest of the country rots in misery.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. President Salva Kiir traveled to Moscow today for bilateral talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin. President Kiir's office stated that the two leaders will explore various opportunities for bilateral collaboration between Juba and Moscow. The discussions will also focus on efforts to lift the 2018 United Nations Security Council arms embargo imposed on South Sudan and targeted sanctions on individuals within the Kiir administration. For more on this development, my colleague Nabil Biagio spoke with Hamdi Hassan, a professor of political science at Cairo University.
With the war in Sudan, the Russians can have some of their own food in Sudan. Why? Because I think they have an agreement to have a naval base in Port Sudan. You remember when Al-Burhan had a visit to Salva Kiir and they consider South Sudan as a good platform for any possible negotiation with RSF. When it comes to Russia here, they try to achieve some of the geostrategic gains in the area. If we have in our consideration their own presence through the Wagner group in the Sahel, and also the historical presence of Wagner in Sudan itself. I think we have to take all of this in our consideration if we are going to look at this bilateral talk between Russia and South Sudan, between Putin and Salva Kiir.
And what is in it for South Sudan and for President Kiir?
You know, always when it comes to America and the West, they have their own conditionality. So the Americans, if they negotiate, they're keen about implementing the agreement between the two enemies in South Sudan and to have the transition, the elections on the track. But the Chinese and the Russian, they don't care about these internal issues, and they can provide assistance to whoever in the power. This is why all these pariah states going toward the China and Russia.
And President Kiir was just here in New York. He was just in the U.S. and now he's heading to Russia. Does that not sour relationships with the U.S.?
No, there is a power shift in the world after the Ukraine war. The United States and the Western ally focusing on Ukraine, as I said. And now in Asia, China is rising, and now the BRICS has extended its membership. So you have the rising power or the swing countries. They capture the opportunity and they can maneuvering going from one side to another side. So there is a room in this changing world for political maneuvering and for the rising power or even the global South countries to maximize their benefits, right? Moving from one side to another side. Yes, you can attend the U.S.-Africa summit and the next day you can go to Russia-Africa summit.
And just finally, is it good for a country like South Sudan or Sudan to seek or strengthen relations with Russia or China, given that you've already said these are countries that don't care about your human rights record, they don't care about what you're doing internally, they just mean business and they pursue their strategic interests. Is it in the interest of a country like South Sudan to seek relations with Russia?
As I said before, always there is political conditionality from the Western power, including the United States. So if you have a political leader who came through unconstitutional means, through a coup d'etat, of course, this is again the law that the United States could provide any assistance for any authority came illegally to power. When we talk about the South Sudan, when they have on the verge of a civil war and the due election and they're on crisis and they are not on the right track, I think they can get some kind of assistance, what they need or support. Remember that Russia has a veto power, so any move in the United Nations to put more pressure on these countries, it could be curtailed by the veto power of Russia or of China.
That's Hamdi Hassan, professor of political science at Cairo University. He was speaking with my colleague Nabil Biagio from Cairo this past hour. Still on South Sudan, a South Sudanese analyst says the appointment of Angelina Teny as the new Minister of Interior could be a violation of the 2018 peace agreement. Jok Madud Jok says President Salva Kiir should consult widely with signatories of the peace agreement before making unilateral decisions on matters to do with the terms of the agreement.
The story of how Ms. Angelina Teny was removed from the Ministry of Defense. First of all, the news was that this ministry would be swapped for the Ministry of Interior, that IO will take Interior and Defense to go back to the SPLM faction under Salva Kiir. And then there was the story that the reason why this happened was some issues to do with national security, with regards to the relationship between the SSPDF, the South Sudan National Defense Forces, and at the border with Sudan. So there were some issues, suspicion that Angelina may have been involved in decisions and activities that denote advance the national security of South Sudan.
This sounds like hearsay. Since Angelina is not here to defend herself, what are some of your sources, reliable sources, telling you the exact reasons are? Because people are asking if the revitalized peace agreement gave the Ministry of Defense to SPLM-IO, why did President Kiir swap the ministry? Because right now Angelina is in Interior and someone who is at the Ministry of Defense is loyal to President Salva Kiir.
Yeah, the nature of evidence when it comes to the politics of South Sudan is a bit tricky. But there was a document shared very widely on social media suggesting that Angelina had signed some security deals with folks in Khartoum. This was before the eruption of Sudan's war. So that's really how far we can go with this evidence. But otherwise, you are right. Much of this is always gossip and hearsay. So we do not know. But what we know for a fact, as you said, is that the dismissal of Angelina Teny from the Ministry of Defense was very much a violation of the arrangement, of the power-sharing arrangement between the two parties of the SPLM.
But supporters of President Kiir will tell you that President Kiir is the president of the Republic of South Sudan, and he has constitutional powers to hire and fire. How do you react to that?
That may be the case, but what South Sudan is being run by today is not the interim constitution of South Sudan 2011. The document that is used today to run this country under is a new arrangement brought by the peace agreement that was signed in Khartoum in 2018. And so if you were to run a country based on a new arrangement, which is being appended to the constitution, that power that you have as president is null and void. It may also be that the SPLM-IO faction did not stand its own ground
I was in Juba in March when Madame Angelina was fired from her docket as the defense minister. I was in Juba and I saw a letter from Dr. Riek Machar complaining and requesting for a meeting with President Kiir. I remember the weekend they were supposed to meet. They never met. So we cannot say with liberty that SPLM-IO did not stand their grounds. They made noise.
They made noise, but to what effect if they eventually accepted? The position of Angelina is a fait accompli. She does not have the docket anymore, which means that if you really, really wanted to contest this, the only rational decision to make, the other position being offered to IO, which is the Interior. But now she has been appointed yesterday to become the Minister of Interior. And I think this is an indication that the SPLM-IO under Riek Machar has simply cowed to President Kiir. And President Kiir has no right to do this reshuffling without consulting them. And so protecting by means of a document is not enough.
Yeah, Jogmadur Jog, how did you know that President Kiir did not consult Dr. Riek Machar in regards to this appointment? Because Machar is the head of the SPLM-IO and Madame Angelina is a member of the SPLM-IO. How did you know that Machar was not consulted?
Well, Machar wrote a letter saying that this was a unilateral decision by Salva Kiir. He did that. And Salva Kiir did not object to it. He did not rebuff that. So we know that indeed this decision was done by Salva Kiir, and Riek Machar had a choice, either to accept it and put their tails between their legs and move on in order to protect the little they have, or say, we are out of here. Because if the agreement is being violated so flagrantly and reshuffles is being done without us, and positions are being swapped without our opinion, then this whole peace agreement is a sham, and it's not longer going to be something that we can stand by.
Jogmadur Jog, I know you are known for apportioning blames on both sides, but you sound in this interview like, you know, blaming the SPLM-IO for what you are calling putting their tail in between their legs and running away.
No, I'm not blaming just one party. I'm already stating that Salva Kiir has violated the agreement. So the onus is on him. But the IO did not protest that in a more meaningful way. Otherwise, they would not have accepted to take the new position, which now Madame Angelina has taken.
But how would you expect a party to protest when they sat together and only implemented Chapter 1 in the peace agreement, which is about power sharing, and everybody's comfortable in their, you know, dockets, enjoying what South Sudanese would call the loots of the country? How would you blame them?
Well, of course, this is what every South Sudanese is saying nowadays, that that this so-called peace agreement with all these clauses that have not been settled, and nobody within the agreement complaining about the unfinished business of the peace agreement, is basically an agreement between the parties to continue to have their posh offices while the rest of the country rots in misery.
That's Jogmadur Jog, professor of anthropology at Syracuse University here in New York. He's also the co-founder of the Juba-based Saud Institute. He spoke to me from New York this past hour. Egypt's foreign minister, Hassan Shawki, says his government is working closely with Saudi Arabia, the United States, and the African Union to try to negotiate an end to the conflict in Sudan. The fighting between Sudan's army and the paramilitary rapid support forces has killed thousands of civilians and forced more than 3 million people to flee their homes. Tens of thousands have left to Egypt. In an interview with VOA's Peter Clody, Foreign Minister Hassan Shawki discusses the Sudan conflict and efforts to end it.
We have been applying our relationships to our Sudanese brethren, our contacts with all of the participants, whether in the military or in the civilian component, primarily in the military, to instill the importance of reaching a ceasefire in dealing with the humanitarian consequences of this conflict and in moving towards a broader dialogue that can chart a roadmap for a future and lead to elections and a stable and a unified government for Sudan that preserves the interests of its people, it preserves its territorial integrity, and provides the traditional role of Sudan to play an active role within the context of its African association to Eastern Africa, to the African Union. We continue to do so. President Sisi initiated the summit of the neighbors of Sudan. We have met as foreign ministers in N'Djamena to formulate a roadmap that has been endorsed, and we met here on the margins of the GA to operationalize that roadmap after the heads of state have endorsed it. I hope that those efforts, and they will address the security perspective, the humanitarian perspective, and the political perspective, each of the neighboring countries utilizing its deep relationships with various sectors of the Sudanese political entities, the military, the civilian component, to attract them to see the importance of ending this conflict, of providing the support to the Sudanese people and expanding the dialogue.
At this ongoing UN General Assembly, the head of the Sudan National Army called on the international community to designate the RSF as a terrorist organization. If this is done, will this help the process to resolve the ongoing conflict and to bring peace, like you said, Egypt is trying to rally around people to solve?
Well, we are concentrating on ending the military confrontation and providing a format for political discussions between those concerned to reach an understanding that relieves the consequences and pressures on the Sudanese people. That is our main focus in collaboration with the other formats that are involved in the issues related to Sudan. It's important also to maintain the structures of the institutions of governance, the legitimacy and the national state entities as the viable protector of the interests of the Sudanese people. I think we have seen the experience in our region of countries that have imploded and that have fragmented and do not have institutions of government that can represent the country and provide services to the people and to their citizens.
That was Egyptian Foreign Minister Hassan Shawki. He spoke with my colleague Peter Clodi recently on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly in New York. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, U.S. President Joe Biden joins a strike by workers in Michigan. That story is lined up right after the break. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. President Joe Biden on Tuesday became the first non-sitting U.S. president to join a labor strike, standing with auto workers in Michigan as they campaign for a 40% pay rise and a 32-hour work week. But can the top government employee move the top three American automakers? VOA's Anita Powell reports from Washington.
What do we want?
Country!
Now!
Unions President Joe Biden likes to say, built America. On Tuesday, he became the first sitting U.S. president on a picket line, joining striking workers in the Detroit suburbs as they entered week two of their walkout seeking higher pay, a shorter work week, and other changes from the nation's top three automakers. Biden is being careful to not say which terms he backs, saying instead that he supports workers' rights.
Stick with it. You deserve the significant raise you need and other benefits.
Let's get it!
Let's get back who we lost, okay?
The president of the powerful United Auto Workers Union, which endorsed Biden's presidential run in 2020, but hasn't yet done the same for his 2024 bid, thanked him. UAW President Sean Fain.
Thank you for coming to stand up with us in our generation's defining moment.
The union claims more than 400,000 members. Many point to the sharp rise in company profits and CEO pay, but also the much smaller rise in worker pay. At a march last week, one worker said this strike is about much more than terms. It's about how Americans think about work and corporate compensation. Yolanda Downs is a UAW member.
I want the levels to be balanced. I want everyone to make a good living and a fair living. If I'm working on one side of the line and I'm making $30 and the person across from me is making $15 an hour, how is that fair?
General Motors, the largest of the big three automakers, avoided any direct comment on Biden's appearance, but issued a statement saying, "Our focus is not on politics, but continues to be on bargaining in good faith with the UAW leadership to reach an agreement as quickly as possible." Political science professor Susan Kang says Biden's decision to stand with workers is significant. But can he tip the balance of negotiations?
Probably not, because there's a lot of things going on in the specifics of the negotiations, but he can shift the political support. We already have an overwhelming amount of support from the public for the strike. And I think this is going to further legitimize the position of the striking workers.
Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump plans to rally at a non-union plant near Detroit on Wednesday instead of participating in the second presidential primary debate that day. In a statement, he dismissed Biden's Detroit trip as a PR stunt. Kang says many older politicians may be missing a broader movement among millennial workers.
I think that there's a wave, a tide towards greater intolerance of deep socioeconomic inequality that really has sort of characterized my lifetime.
But as Biden and Trump know, the pictures often tell a story of their own. Here is the top U.S. government worker saying, without needing to say a word, something needs to change. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
From Washington, we go to Southern Africa, where some Zimbabweans living in abject poverty are reacting angrily to claims by President Emmerson Mnangagwa that the country's economy is the fastest growing in the South African region. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, where some economists and members of the main opposition say the president is being misinformed or does not understand basic economy.
At the just ended United Nations General Assembly, Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa said his country's economy was the fastest growing in Southern Africa.
"We are recording unprecedented development and economic success milestones. For the last 3 years, our country has been the fastest growing economy in our Southern Africa region. Further, Zimbabwe is prioritizing the eradication of poverty and improving the quality of life of our people."
But in Harare, Lighton Chamani depends on part-time gardening to make a living. The unemployed 37-year-old says the past 3 years have been difficult for him. Chamani says he makes so little money that he cannot send his children to school. He needs money for school fees, his wife, and other obligations. He hopes to get a sponsorship so he can make music and uplift the lives of other Zimbabweans. Former Finance Minister Tendai Biti, a leader of the main opposition party, disagrees with President Mnangagwa's assessment of the economy. He says the president is seriously ill-informed and misinformed, as 79% of the population is living in extreme poverty.
Over a third, they have to rely on food assistance from the WFP and other UN agencies. More than 90% of the population is informal, employment. Everywhere where you go, there is decay in infrastructure, decay in the mindset. So there's a lot of propaganda, there's a lot of misinformation. This is a limping economy.
Prosper Chitambara is a senior economist with the Labour and Economic Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe. He says Zimbabwe's economy took a nosedive in 2019 and 2020 due to Cyclone Idai and drought. He's also concerned about the effect of inflation on citizens as well as poverty levels.
Our currency has been affected by the inflation. We've seen a depreciation of the currency. So the value obviously has been decimated by inflation.
Chitambara says that Zimbabwe needs to increase production and stabilize its currency so it can think of sustained growth and reaching an upper middle income economy, which President Mnangagwa wants to achieve by 2030. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
42,000 women serve in the Ukrainian military, and the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense has recently officially approved a female uniform. Lysia Baklets has the story from Kyiv.
Maria, an officer of the Ukrainian Armed Forces, tries on a military uniform for women for the first time. Why haven't I seen this earlier, she says. It's just gorgeous. Maria, who did not give her surname, says this is the most comfortable coat and pair of pants she's worn since she started her military service. The model is very cool. Look, she says, the pants are exactly on my waist, no lower, no higher. In addition, they are adjustable. I can fix and make them narrower if needed. Maria joined the armed forces as the Russian full-scale invasion began in February 2022. Like other females in the Ukrainian military, she says she received a male uniform. It's like a uniform from an older brother, says Maria. They gave you something and you had to adjust it for your type of body. The smallest boot size started from 40, but I am a 36, so I waited a long time to get shoes that fit me. Officer Olga Bigar spoke with VOA from the front line. We are in the Bakhmut region, she says, performing tasks related to the deoccupation of the territory. Bigar says her pants fit so poorly, they often lasted just one mission. They were practically for one-time use, she says. You go on some combat mission, fall down several times, and the same are already split. Now Olga Bigar and Maria have military uniforms for women, thanks to volunteers from the Ukrainian social initiative Arm Women Now. Irina Nakurak is the head of the initiative. She says that they collected samples of women's uniforms from other armies worldwide. The NATO standards and uniforms from the USA were used as a basis. Also, they comply with the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense equivalent requirements for male uniforms. Volunteers have been making the women's uniforms for a year. Women who are serving on the front line get the uniforms for free. Others pay a flat fee. Irina Nakurak says they were tested for safety and comfort on the training grounds.
A fitted
jacket is essential when a woman wears a bulletproof vest, she says. Otherwise, there are a lot of folds from the excess fabric formed. In summer, when the temperature is high, this extra fabric rubs, creating discomfort. This August, the Ukrainian Defense Ministry approved women's summer field uniforms that are expected to be available by the end of the year. Tatiana Kucher, physical property development specialist for Ukrainian military, says that visually the uniform is similar to the general military uniform. It is designed according to a female figure, smaller shoulders, slightly shorter length, narrower sleeves, and a waist that can be adjusted. The Ukrainian Ministry of Defense says there are a total of 42,000 females in the Ukrainian military, 5,000 of them serving in the combat zone. Lysia Bakalets for VOA News, Kyiv.
That's all we prepared for you this Wednesday, September 27, 2023. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14. If you miss this broadcast, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. Remember? Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.